So welcome everybody to today's episode of the Independent Teacher Podcast. And I'm really pleased to be joined by Dr. Andy Phippen. Andy, welcome to today's show.
Hi Susan, good to see you.
Okay, so there are so many things I want to talk to you about today, Andy, but perhaps one of the areas that we're going to look at is this clear disconnect that there is between what young people worry about in terms of what's happening online and what the adults are concerned about. And also, I want to go into a little bit more detail with you about why it's so difficult for young people to talk to adults about what is sometimes happening to them online. So that's basically what we're going to do. And I'm sure there are a lot of other things that we're going to look at along the way. But could you just begin by telling our listeners about your current role?
Okay, so rather grandly, my formal title is Professor of Digital Rights. I'm at Bournemouth University at the moment. I'm basically an academic who works, I've worked with young people for about 20 years on these sorts of issues. So back 20 years ago, we were talking to young people about MSN and stuff like that. These days, we're talking to them about Snapchat and Roblox and all sorts of other things. But what we see is there are similar discourses occurring. And I also spend a lot of time working with stakeholders in the area, so teachers, policymakers, governors, parents. And there is certainly, you know, as you were saying, the disconnect between adult concerns and young people's concerns is kind of like where I'm at. I kind of flipped around what I do probably about 5 years ago, because I used to spend a lot of time talking about what young people do online. Now what I talk about far more is how you respond to what young people talk to you about, or how you get young people to talk to you about what they do online, because that's the more fundamental issue. Is if a young person is vulnerable or at risk or upset in some way, we want to provide an environment where they can disclose without fear of a telling off or being told they've been stupid or something. And that's the thing that's been consistent probably through the entire 20 years of the work I've done. They will not disclose to an adult because for fear of being told off or any of those other things as well. So yeah, I write a lot about the area. I've influenced a couple of pieces of legislation along the way, but still by far the best part of my job is sitting in a room with some young people going, right, talk to me about how the online world affects your life and talk to me about how we can help you.
Okay, I think, you know, there isn't a day that goes by where we don't see some headline in the newspaper about the detrimental effects of technology on the emotional well-being of young people. So what has your research actually indicated about the impact of digital technology on pupil well-being? I know that's quite a big question to answer.
Yeah. No worries. It does tie in with an even bigger question, which is, where is your evidence to form that opinion? The real answer to that is we don't really know, because it's a very difficult thing when you're looking broadly at mental health. And certainly I work with a lot of schools and colleges. The college where I'm a trustee, we've seen a significant increase in mental health disclosures post-COVID. So we know there are bigger concerns around that. To isolate it and say that's because of digital platforms is really quite a challenging thing to do. And we've been doing some work. I live in Cornwall. I work in Cornwall. I do a lot of work with Cornish School. We've been doing work for about 7 years now, looking at early intervention, mental health issues, mental health first aid in schools, those sorts of things. And we started from a position of going, all right, we need to look at, you know, the online influence. What do you think we should do? And we started to dig around and go, well, there's not really anything that can show a causation. So let's start asking young people. And what really came out of that was the fact that what we might be worried about and we project onto young people isn't the same as them. And, you know, what I remember one young person sort of saying post-COVID, because there was a lot of chat around COVID about how they were more at risk of grooming because they're online more. And one young person sort of said to me, he said, look, we've been told that if we go and see our nan, we're going to kill her. We've been told that there's this disease that's going around that's really risky and civilization might be over. We've been told that the world's going to come to an end because of climate change. We've been told we'll never be able to get a job or afford a house. And you think social media is the problem. And I thought that was absolutely brilliant, because, you know, kind of like, but they're using social media more and there's an increase in mental health disclosures. It must be because of that. But let's look at more broadly at society. With all of these things, it's very difficult to isolate a variable. You can probably make a little bit of a correlation if you punch the numbers enough. But the work that the Oxford Internet Institute did, Amy Orban and people like that there, on large mental health data sets, saying, there's a very, very weak correlation there. Things like not having breakfast. And, if you look at trauma-informed approaches and you look at classic adverse childhood experiences and things, those are the sorts of things that are far more likely. And there's a demonstrable influence around mental health and saying, oh, it's because they're on social media too much. That's not to say that there aren't issues that arise, but they're generally the stuff that doesn't hit the press as much. So why has that person got more friends than me? Why is that person's profile picture got more likes than my profile picture? I've just been on Snap Maps and seen a bunch of my friends are at a party and I wasn't invited. So it's that sort of stuff where we can approach that from relationships education and talking to them about, what it means to be a friend and what a relationship is and those sorts of things. And talking about the influence of digital, but when you start off with a position, oh, they're on social media more now, therefore it must be a problem. It's a bit like the gaming question, which, I'm told frequently violent video games make violent children. Okay, look, there's really no proof of that whatsoever. When I talk to gamers, the one they say that causes most aggression is FIFA because it's very competitive. And you think you're about to win, then there's a goal scored, and then you've got someone mocking you on a headset and things. So let's open it out a bit more than that. But you will always have the gut reaction of, yeah, but surely if they are running around shooting people the whole time, it would make them like more desensitized to violence. The attempts to show that causation have been going on literally for 40 years. I can show you news articles from the 70s where people were saying, but surely. And there really isn't any evidence to support that. And I think that's one of the important things in this area is, where does the evidence come from to support that judgment rather than, well, it seems right. It's a bit like going back again to the COVID lockdown. They're online a lot more, therefore they're more at risk of grooming now. We did an FOI on all local authorities during lockdown to ask about safeguarding disclosures. There's no increase whatsoever in safeguarding disclosures over that period. And we specifically asked about safeguarding disclosures with an online harms element. Most of them came back to us and said, we don't record online harm separately. So you've got people like Europol and the NCA going, kids are definitely more at risk. And you go, well, you've just said that. And that's really irresponsible because lots of people are now going to go, well, if the police are saying it, then it must be a problem. when actually, again, going back to the conversations post-COVID, I can remember one young man again say, "What? Well, I'm spending 8 hours a day on college work. You think I'm going to spend the evenings talking to paedophiles? Are you stupid?" It's like, well, that's a brutal response, but it's also a very sensible one. He's like, "We're aware of the risks. We've been told about this stuff from a very early age." Now, there was evidence of greater amounts of child sexual abuse material things being circulated by people's sexual interest in children during that period of time. There is evidence for that, but to say they're more at risk and state that as fact are the things that really concern me. But I guess, you're not going to sell a newspaper by saying child uses internet for fun. You're going to sell a newspaper by going kids are more at risk and it's terrible. And I always remember there was a headline from a children's charity saying there had been a 70% increase in child grooming prosecutions in the last 3 years. Online child grooming prosecutions the last 3 years. Now, the legislation didn't exist until 2017. So a better headline would be new child grooming laws working, but that doesn't create the panic and get people like buying into the articles and things. So rather it's going up. Well, of course it's going up. It was at zero 5 years ago because there wasn't a piece of legislation where people were specifically prosecuted for that crime.
Okay, so clearly the media has an awful lot to answer for in terms of sensationalising sometimes what's taking place online. But I do want to come back and just try and pin you down a little bit more about that disconnect between the experiences of young people online and how they are different to the experiences of, say, adults online and how you end up with that disconnect. So, could we just go back and just look at that in a little bit more depth?
I think, a term I really can't stand is, oh, they're digital natives because there's, the idea that someone's born after a certain year and therefore they know inherently about these sorts of things. But there is a case that young people are very immersed in these worlds. And while we will have we as adults will have our own online worlds as well. They will be very different places. The thought of encountering a 15-year-old on Facebook now is like, forget it. Even stuff like Instagram's waning a little bit. So they have a very sort of different world, and it's very embedded in there. Well, it's kind of like, one of the reasons that there was a transition into lockdown was they were spending a lot of time talking to their friends electronically anyway. I think from a parent's perspective and a teaching perspective, if your only information about these young people's digital worlds is the press, and it's not just the right-wing tabloids, it's you look at some of the nonsense articles from the BBC sometimes and things as well, you're going to be in a constant state of anxiety. We do a large survey with young people in schools. We got about 16,000 responses from there consistently over the years. When asked the question, have you been upset by anything that's happened online? 70% of young people say no. That's a headline you never ever see in the press. Most young people aren't upset by stuff that happens online. And then when you probe a little deeper and go, all right, what was it that you were upset by? The majority relate to either child on child spats and fallouts or current affairs. So there's a lot of young people saying that they're worried about climate change. Well, that's no surprise because it's always in the press. When Ukraine war broke out, there was a lot of young people saying that they're worried about war and nuclear war and things. When the Manchester bombing happened, a lot of them were talking about terrorism. So there's, we can show there's links there. So while adults might be worried about serious mental health, access to harmful content, sexualization, those sorts of things, and we're right to have discussions about that, most young people aren't affected by those sorts of things, and most young people are generally doing all right. And this is why I don't really like the term online safety. I think it sets us up with the belief that we can keep young people safe from harm online. Yes, you can, just don't let them go online. Then they are 100% free of risk of harm online. If we're taking the goal as making the online world risk-free, we're never going to achieve that. However, if we provide them with an understanding of what the risks might be and how you mitigate those risks, that's a far more positive experience, because ultimately what we want is a young person who is worried about something to be in a position where they can talk to somebody about it. So yeah, if you've got an adult population that's generally fed hype lines by the media, and you've got young people who are going, well, we've had the online safety assembly 5 times now. We know that there's predatory people online. We're not sure about what you're saying about this legality stuff, and that's not going to stop us doing anything anyway. But that immediately creates a barrier if those are the only conversations that happen. And if the anxiety that a lot of adults have are based upon media reporting and gut feel, and also, I wouldn't have done that, therefore they shouldn't. You get quite a lot of that as well. Now, one of the things I empathize with when I'm sat with a bunch of 14, 15-year-old boys talking about some dodgy stuff. You will have surely experienced teenage boys as well as some of the conversations they have. But once you get over the giggling and the jokes, they've got equally serious questions. But they're just young men trying to understand the world. It's more public than it used to be for my generation, but they are just young men trying to understand the world, maybe trying to get a relationship, because if you're in a relationship, that means you're more popular than if you're not and things. Those things haven't changed. It's just the way their lives are portrayed and projected that's changed now. One of the frustrating things I find about the political stance on this is all new, so we've got to stop it. Like, most of the concerns that young people have aren't new. They're just manifesting in different ways. It's why is my friend being mean to me? Why have I fallen out? Or, why can't I get a partner? And, oh, if in order to get a partner, I'm going to have to take intimate images of themselves and send it to them, and then they might, And if you haven't had good RSC to that point, you might think that is the way that you form relationships and things. There's definitely a disconnect, and I have a great deal of sympathy for adults, particularly those with safeguarding responsibilities around these sorts of things, because you get the alert from the local police force that's got a list of 15 dangerous apps, and then you hear about kids in your school using it, and then you go, oh my God. But, I had a conversation with police officers going, please, can you not send them out? Because it doesn't do anything. It's rarely an app that's dangerous. It's the fact that there's an interaction happening on it. And coincidentally, it's on that app that's dangerous. There was a brilliant headline a few years ago saying "Kick Messenger used in 1,000 grooming cases." So, as someone with safeguard responsibility, I've heard of young people in my school using Kick Messenger. It's rife with paedophiles. That was the implication of this article. But if you take a step back and do a bit of critical thinking on it, I mean, Kick Messenger is basic. I mean, it's waned now, but it's basically like WhatsApp. It was downloaded 300 million times. People with a sexual interest in children will go to spaces where there are children. Kick Messenger might be one of them. But the idea that because there were 1,000 grooming cases where Kick Messenger had been used, there was something specific about Kick Messenger is really quite irresponsible because it immediately creates the barriers up of the conversation. You may as well be saying in 1,000 grooming cases, the predator was wearing jeans. No one was saying, right, we need to ban denim because people who wear denim will groom children. But because it's using that platform, immediately goes, oh, that must be a dangerous platform. There's a predator on Minecraft. Yes, but there's also millions of young people who are interacting with their friends and having a wonderful time in it. A far better message was, if someone asks you something dodgy or you don't know them or you're uncomfortable by it, block them, talk to somebody about it, or take a screen grab, talk to somebody about it. Not, you can't talk, I can't talk to you about this because I know you're going to explode and then you're going to say, I can't go online anymore.
Okay, Andy, so do you have any advice for parents about how they can start to have conversations with their children about any concerns that they may have?
Yeah, avoid a confrontational conversation which starts with, do you do this? Because generally the response to that will be no. There's always stuff in the media. You can say, have you seen this in the news? What do you think about this? Is this something that you and your friends experience? So it stops being a confrontational conversation. It becomes a conversation where the young person is in a position to go, oh, that's nonsense. Oh, I can't believe they're doing that. Or yes, we know about that. We've had plenty of assemblies about that. Or yes, that is a concern. And also having those conversations early. If you're talking about something like teen sexting, which I've written about a huge amount, and still young people say the same things, which is, well, we've been told it's illegal, so we're not going to disclose because we'll get arrested if we disclose, which isn't strictly speaking the case at all. It's far more complicated than that. You can't have a conversation at primary school about teen sexting or with a primary school age child, but you can have a conversation about if someone asks you to do something you're uncomfortable with, it's okay to say no, and it's okay to talk to us about it. Because the first conversation you want with them about this sort of thing isn't when they're 14 and someone's harassing them for nudes. But it's kind of like, oh, that's, if someone asks you to do something you're uncomfortable with and you say no and they start badgering you about it, that's not very nice, is it? Or you should talk to somebody about it because it's okay to say no. If you don't want to do something, you don't have to do it. Whereas if they're 14, hormonal, and they believe this is the way you establish a relationship, and the cognitive psych say about the breakdown of the prefrontal cortex during teenage years, so you don't understand risk as well, they're probably in a more vulnerable position than if you laid the foundations early. And it always comes back to whenever I'm having a discussion group with young people, there'll be two or three that will say yes, they'll talk to a parent. There'll be two or three who go, no way. It's entirely down to the relationship dynamic they have with their parents, but it's generally as a result of, well, I've had conversations with my parents about this sort of thing, and I know that if I did have something serious to say, their first response isn't going to be to freak out. I think it's laying the foundations early. Again, the fact that online harms are presented as this new, different thing, and the fact that we're told as adults, you don't really understand these sorts of things. Well, we do understand relationships, and we do understand friendship, and we do understand the need to wish to be popular and thinking you're attractive and all those sorts of things. That's not different when we were growing up to what it's like now. And I do sometimes think adults forget what it was like when they were a teenager and immediately go, well, I wouldn't have done that. It's like, well, wouldn't you? If you'd had a communications network and a camera in your pocket and the means to do it, are you sure you wouldn't do that? So yeah, the having early conversations, the first conversation shouldn't be, what the hell are you doing? What are you looking at? Conversation shouldn't start with, I've been looking at your phone and I need to speak to you about something like that. I mean, we could probably do a whole podcast on children's right to privacy. But those sorts of conversations that should start early, so the young person is in a position where they go, well, I think I'm in a position where I can talk to my parent about this. And it might not necessarily be one parent or the other, but they might have a parent and they're not going to freak out and they're going to help me with it. The last thing they need to hear, particularly if they have done something that they're upset by, is you've been stupid or you shouldn't have done that. It's like, well, how does that help anybody at all? And you get these really crass educational messages that have been around for years. Once it's online, it's always online. You can't do anything about it. Well, you can. There are people you can talk to about these sorts of things. If there are images of you as a 15-year-old being circulated on online platforms, those online platforms do not want those images on their platform. So if you report them, they will be taken down. If they're not taken down immediately, there are other organizations you can contact that will have these things taken down. So that message is there's nothing you can do about it now, or you've been stupid. Avoid that, even if it's your first response is, what have you done that for? They don't need to hear that. But yeah, I do think starting early is the most important thing. So it's not high risk, difficult conversation territory. It's just stuff about what people do, how you feel, and those sorts of things.
Okay, so that's really interesting. So you mentioned there about digital footprint. Now, I am aware that in the education field, if you apply for a job and you get through to the final round, then there will have been a trawl of what you have left or put out on social media. And I just wondered if you had any views on that.
I find that really weird. I mean, it's come out of the latest edition of Keeping Children Safe in Education and Safer Recruitment and things. The question I always push back to DfE is, what does good enough look like in terms of this? Because I can remember having a conversation with a couple of years ago saying to this charity, you need to do a social media scan of all teachers because you might catch paedophiles that way. I said, I don't think paedophiles post that sort of thing on Facebook, I think managing your privacy settings is always advisable, and getting someone else to check what they can see and those sorts of things. But equally, everyone's got a digital footprint there, and if someone's going to take exception to something, I think you've probably got reasonable grounds to come back to them and go, why didn't I get shortlisted for that? And if they say, oh, because of your social media, it's perfectly reasonable to push back on that. It's as soon as someone becomes a celebrity or a sports personality or something, what's the first thing that they do? They go back and trawl through their Twitter from 10 years ago. Go, oh, look, they said this offensive joke 10 years ago. At some point, you have to think in society, we'll get to a point going, well, yeah, that's what people do and things. I do find it a very weird part of the new version of Keeping Children Safe in Education. I think there are things, like I said, there are things you can just make sure your stuff's not public. You can go back and delete stuff. It's not like your average person's Twitter feed isn't going to have been harvested and archived by somebody. But I'm just not sure what they're hoping to find. I know it's come from a few historical cases where people have been recruited, then it turns out that they've been an abuser or something. But surely that's about good DBS practices.
Okay, Andy, thanks for your take on that and also for your advice as well to our listeners. Now, believe it or not, we've almost reached the end of our conversation. So what I want to do is I want to find out if you've got any views about AI, which is constantly in the news these days, but also about the development of the metaverse for learning. And I suppose to put it all into a context, what I be very interested to know is, are you looking forward with all your expertise and everything with a sense of optimism or a sense of increasing concern?
First of all, to all your listeners, I can reassure you, AI is not magic, and regardless of what Sarah Vine said in the Daily Mail, it's not going to take over the world. We don't know how the human brain works, so there's absolutely no way of implementing an algorithm that can replicate the human brain. Let's start off with that. ChatGPT and things like that are very, very impressive, but they're very, very impressive at doing a very narrow domain thing, which is producing text or producing code or something. And I think if you understand how it works, you can see what a valuable tool it is. I think we've got a role as educators to better understand it. I think there's a challenge with our own digital literacy. If we understand it better, we can understand the tools better. I can show you papers from 20 years ago saying that essays are never going to be written again because of search engines. We need to ban search engines. 30 years ago, I can show you a whole raft of literature saying that students need to handwrite essays rather than type them because it improves their critical thinking. And 40 years ago, I can show you how calculators were going to absolutely like ruin, decimate numeracy skills. And what's happened to each of these innovations is they've eventually become adopted and become useful tools. The idea now that you say to a student, you're not allowed to use a search engine for this. But at the time, there was a huge amount of flap and moral panic around it. One of the great things you can do with stuff like ChatGPT, generate something and then get young people to pick it apart and go, right, what's accurate, what isn't accurate? Because, you know, if you, it's extremely impressive because its processing power and the sheer scale of the data it's got, but it's still working on data from 2021 that's getting more and more stale the whole time. I know I did an ego browse on GPT myself for my own profile, and it's about 75% accurate and 25% nonsense. If you understand how it works, you understand how that happens. So yeah, you know, do a little bit more reading and learning around it rather than just going, I'm never going to be able to mark an essay again. You know, do some. I did an accreditation visit of a university at the start of the week, talking to computer science students, and they said in one of their classes the professor generated some code with GPT, and then they said, right, we're going to spend the next hour finding the bugs in it, taking it apart, and then understanding how it generated it like this. I thought, well, that's the innovative, progressive approach. As far as the metaverse is concerned, I get really confused with the metaverse because, first of all, the concept has been around for a long time, avatar-based environments. I don't know if you can remember Second Life, but I'm certainly old enough to remember Second Life, which was an avatar-based, supposedly learning environment, which is going to completely replace the campus and everyone's going to interact online. Just turned out it was a bit naff and no one actually wanted to use it. I've very rarely met a young person that thinks the concept of a VR-based metaverse is cool. It's generally 50-year-old tech executives who think it's cool. You know, you know, there's gamers that think, you know, gaming, if you've got a flight sim and you've got a headset on, it's brilliant. But for most young people, it's kind of like, but we've got loads of ways of interacting with our friends that don't require us to isolate ourselves from the world and put on a headset. I'm old enough to have seen many hype waves about both AI and virtual reality, and they never come around to what was predicted. I think AI has got more potential than VR-based metaverse activities, but can you see a bunch of kids going, oh, brilliant, we've got class now, we're all going to sit with our headsets on and interact with the person next to us in an online environment, particularly that it's not a particularly impressive virtual world as well. So I mean, you know, we could do a podcast in a year and go, I was wrong, everyone's learning in VR headsets now, but I don't think I will. You know, again, probably the best learning environment you can have is a discussion with a group of young people in the classroom where they're all confident, they're voicing their opinions and learning from each other and learning from the members of staff in the room as well, rather than connect to this online world and explore this online world. It's like, really? That's all a little bit naff, isn't it? And of course, the techies will go, this is brilliant, it's going to change the world. They want you to buy their products. You know? Particularly in the education sector, you know, buy our filtering and monitoring system, it will keep all of the kids safe. Well, it'll help, but it won't keep all of the kids safe, because that requires human intervention and support and routes for disclosure and all those sorts of things as well. Buy our educational product, it's amazing. Well, you're going to say that, mate, you're a salesman. They're not going to go, well, I'm not sure whether this will catch on. So, you know, if you go to something like BetNow, there's tons of metaverse-based stuff and VR-based stuff. But whenever I talk to young people about it, none of them are going, oh, I want a headset for Christmas. I want an Oculus Rift for Christmas. They go, I want whatever the next version of the Xbox is, or the PS5, isn't it? The PS5 was that's what gamers were talking about, not having a headset stuff. So.
Oh, thanks ever so much, Andy. It's been great talking to you today and obviously putting everything into context at the end there about AI and the metaverse for learning. So thank you once again for joining our listeners on today's show. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you ever so much.
Brilliant.
You have been listening to the Independent Teacher Podcast. If you like listening to this podcast, please consider giving us a 5-star rating either on Spotify or Apple Podcasts.